Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Phil Pelletieri back with us to talk about the world of insects. He's an entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, and he retired as head of the insect diagnostic lab at UW in 2014. How the time flies. And he comes by every so often to talk with us about insects. You may have a question about something that's going on in your house, or maybe you've just got a general interest question about insects. I hope you'll join us. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, the title of the page, The Larry Mueller Show. And Phil Pelletieri, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
Well, this time of year, you know, for myself, Emily and I went out and cut down a Christmas tree, hauled it into the house, and I watched for bugs. I didn't see any, and nothing seems to have shown up, but I know the Christmas trees, the holiday plants are invitation for insects to get in.
I didn't see it a lot. But on occasion, there is a very large black aphid that is associated with conifers. So you can bring them in on Christmas trees. And the ones we were seeing are basically ones that would be hangovers from this fall. It is a late summer, early fall aphid. They really don't hurt anything other than you've got to be careful. If you crush them, they leave almost a berry-like stain.
Oh.
So that's a concern. So first of all, you know, it's not typical for trees to bring things in. I know there was an urban legend years ago that deer ticks were overwintering on trees. That's not the way they work. But that's the one that does come to mind, as I said, this large aphid. And you could kill them with a soapy water spray if you needed to. And as I said, the only caution is not to crush them. And for the gardeners that are used to looking at aphids, they're about twice the size of an average aphid. I mean, they really are giant aphids is the way things go. But again, on the tree that's cut, they don't hurt anything. You know, live trees wouldn't have the bark beetles and those kind of things you expect with firewood type stuff with dead trees. Yeah. So as I said, there really isn't a big concern with Christmas trees.
So if you do have something, if something does manage to get in, what do you do?
Yeah, most of the time the number is going to be low enough and whatnot. It's just as easy to you know, sweep them out, vacuum them up, whatever you need to do. And as I said, you know, if the numbers were of concern, you know, soapy water spray as a knockdown, and then just pick them up carefully with a vacuum cleaner, and you should be done.
Yeah, and my cats would be climbing up the tree and finding any insect that happened to be in there. And so I don't really worry too much about it. They love it when an insect should appear, because then they've got something to chase after play with. Oh, my gosh. And it does seem, though, that there are more insects, especially, I guess, during wintertime than I remember. I guess I haven't had the problem with the lady beetles that other people have had, but is there, you know, any truth to that? That there's,
well, you know, that's an example of an insect that wasn't there when I was growing up in the state, and so it's something different, and one of its claims to fame is this invading homes to find an overwintering spot. Another one that does it, there's this very large brown creature. Some people would call it a stink bug, but it's really a leaf-footed bug. And again, early in my career, I rarely saw it, and it's really become quite commonplace. It's kind of like box elder bugs. It invades in the fall, not quite the number. So, you know, my perspective is, yes, there are things here that weren't here before that are notorious for trying to overwinter in people's houses. So, I do think there's more critters to deal with. And honestly, there's some ants, too. They're not native ants, but some of these tropical tramp ants that have moved in that could move into your house and basically keep active all winter long. So, yeah, things do change.
Let's go to Helen in Madison with a question. Hi, Helen. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have discovered this insect or bug in my home. I can describe it for you.
Okay.
It's got an antenna, and it's got six legs. The legs, no, the body, including the antenna and the legs, is about one inch long. The body itself is about a half inch. And the body is shaped like a shield. It's dark brown in color.
Mm-hmm.
The underside is a little lighter.
Okay. What I'm suspicious of is a creature. It is a stink bug called a brown marmorated stink bug. And this is one of the other newer invaders.
Yeah.
In fact, I tease my colleagues. This is one of the reasons Phil retired, because we knew this insect was potentially going to become an issue. And it's becoming more commonplace in parts of the state. And, numbers, you can be lucky and find four or five all winter long, and that's not so bad. But what has happened out on the East Coast is people are finding it by the hundreds, if not thousands, in the worst-case scenarios. Now, we're not quite there yet, but if I had to guess, because your description of it being shield-shaped and the color and whatnot, that would be a very likely one. And again, what has happened is it came in during October and November. It is trying to stay in sheltered places, but when you get the warmth of the house or a sunny day, some of them wake up, and to be honest, they think it's spring already, which seems amazing. But and what's frustrating about this is, the ones in front of you, again, you can sweep out, vacuum, just get rid of, but you may get this kind of trickling effect, because the ones that are in the walls that haven't quite woke up now may wake up later. And so when it becomes a problem over time, the strategies are either to figure out where they're crawling in from outside and try to get that sealed up before next year, or in worst case scenarios, they spray, but the spraying is done in October, not now. It really is not effective to spray now, because the ones in the walls you can't reach.
Well, they're very lethargic, so I can pick them up without them getting away from me.
Yeah, and that's part of, both because insects' movement is temperature-related, so they've come from somewhere of a cold place. 50 degrees is kind of the cutoff. Below 50 degrees, insects don't have a very easy time moving at all. And so that helps. The one thing you may notice a little bit, because as the name implies, if you handle them, they do have this rather distinctive odor that sometimes lingers. And that's one of the problems when they become very numerous. When you suck them up in a vacuum cleaner, your vacuum cleaner will have this odor for a period of time.
Yeah. So keep an eye out, I guess.
Yeah, they're not damaging. They're a nuisance. That's the unfortunate thing. But there's nothing to worry about them biting you or, damaging anything in the house.
There we go.
I found two on my kitchen counter yesterday.
And where are you located?
Madison.
Madison.
Okay.
Right.
Wait. I will be honest, you from, P.J. Leash, who now is running the lab. P.J. and I have fun talking war stories about all kinds of things going on. And, he did see a real bump up of brown marmorated stink bug last year in the state, and be darned if it wasn't kind of the near west side of Madison was the hot spot in the Vilas neighborhood area, a little bit on the west side too. So of all the places, even though we've seen it in Green Bay and we've seen it in Racine and a few other places, Madison does seem to be the hot spot for that insect right now.
Yeah. We do have pictures of it.
If you could send a photo.
Yeah, you could send it to PJ. Just send it to the Insect Diagnostic Lab, he will get it. Although, again, you can look, if you have access to the Internet, look under brown brown stink bug, and this one will come up, because it's an Asian species that has been causing problems in the U.S. now for about 15 years, but it's only been the recent 4 or 5 years we've seen any activity in the state, and as I said, it seems to be ramping up.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
On to Heather in Somerset. Hi, Heather.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I recently got married, and I wonderful, wonderful husband who loves spiders, because there are webs that, despite how hard I work to get the webs out, they keep reappearing, and I can't get rid of the spiders in the house.
Okay, what have you been doing? Have you just been kind of sweeping the webs?
Sweeping the webs, vacuuming the spiders up when I see them. I don't really want to spray because we have small dogs and grandchildren. Mm-hmm. I've heard that leaving cotton balls with peppermint oil on it will drive them away. I don't know what to do.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there really is no scientifically proven repellent. To be honest, one of the common discussions has been Osage orange, which is a tree that grows south of us, has this great big almost pineapple-like nut, and there are some extracts of that have turned out to be spider repellents, but the problem is if you buy one of these Osage orange balls and you put them in your house, the only way the repellent works is if you chemically extract it and spray it, forget that. As I said, I don't have any home remedies. Honestly, we've always found that the vacuum is probably the best defense, but to put the attachment on, and you start getting in all the corners and cracks and crevices. The other thing is you try as much as possible to keep clutter to a minimum, because it just gives you more places for the spiders to hide out. Now,
But they've got to be eating something.
Yeah, well, that's part of what we always walk into is if spiders are thriving, there has to be a lot of insect material for them to feed on. And so that's often trying to solve what is the riddle with the insects. If you can reduce the spider food, there should be less spiders. But as I said, there really is no easy answer to this to make them all go away, other than, as I said, of really spending the time and getting in every nook and cranny you can with an attachment to try to reduce the population. The thing about spiders is they can't breed very quickly. They're really slow breeders compared to cockroaches, ants, and a few other things. And so usually if you go through a moderate effort, you do get relief for a period of months is what you'd expect.
Okay. Well, time to get out the vacuum cleaner hoses.
All right. There you go. Thanks, Heather.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Kathleen and Spooner, on to you now. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a kind of a strange problem down in one of my rooms in the basement. We had a leak a few years ago from our hot water heat that was the pipes under the cement floor. And so we had that all repaired. They dug it up and repaired it, and everything was just dandy. And then we laid a nice new vinyl floor. And every single winter, I get pounds of sand from the ants that are coming and building tunnels. The ants don't come into the house necessarily, but they dig out, honestly, pounds of sand. There's this pile of sand every winter. I'm afraid the whole that end of the room is going to collapse someday from losing all that sand. We have tried squirting the expanding insulation. We have tried steel wool. We've tried ant poison, which gives us lots of dead ants, but then the next year we still get ants. Mm-hmm. What can I do?
Well, the poison, I don't know if this is cornfield ant or what the species is.
They're small. They're quite small.
Yeah, and which makes me believe it's cornfield ants because they like sand.
Okay.
And so the problem, though, with it is a little bit twofold in that they're not an ant, as you say, that seems to want to come in very often. And, you know, the best way to treat ants typically is to find a bait that they like so that they take it back and feed the queen. Because the secret to ant control is to kill the queen. When you try other strategies, what you're doing is you're killing a lot of workers, but she keeps on generating more workers, and so you don't solve it. So it becomes an access problem. If you found a bait that they like, then I would say you just keep feeding them the bait, and even when it looks like they've stopped taking it, you keep making it available. And for this kind of ant, they tend to have a sweet tooth. So you want to have a bait that has some kind of sugar base.
Uh-huh.
Now, for this kind of ant that does the same thing in, let's say, patio blocks outside, what we find is if you can get the material deep into the ground where the queen is, it might work. And so in that case, you know, we use a little screwdriver or something else to make channels and then treat down under. But I'm afraid the problem that you've got is it's not going to be very accessible.
Yeah.
Now, one other strategy, you know, if I would try the baiting and whatnot first and just keep very aggressive and see if that helps. Your idea of trying to seal them out really was a very good idea, but sometimes it's just hard to find the places where they're coming. So if all else fails, then honestly what you have to look at is having a pest control service come in. And honestly, there are some things that they can do to inject products underneath the slab. And get a more permanent type treatment. But, you know, the cost, the bother, as I said, I would leave that as a last resort. But basically, again, comes down to the point of getting the stuff to where it's going to do the most good. And just spraying along the places they're pushing the sand out, as I said, we'll give you dead ants, but it will not solve the problem.
There we go.
All right. Well, we'll try that. Thanks very much.
Yep. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, UW entomologist, distinguished faculty, associate emeritus, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Marika Suval, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn and her guest look back at the life and times of iconic folk musician Pete Seeger. That's at 2. Right now, taking a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri. And Lori in Wausau has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Lori.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call.
The problem I'm having is we had a beetle that we would find in our house. And we didn't know what they were, so we just named them Jack. And we have since found out that they're a pine beetle, and supposedly they eat the seeds off the pine cone.
Okay. Yeah,
it's ugly.
Yeah, it's not a beetle technically. It is a leaf-footed bug, and we call it the pine seed bug. And the way you can tell the difference is the critters you've got have a great big long beak, which they use to feed in the seeds. True beetles have chewing mouth parts. They don't have a beak like that. But the problem with that one is this is one of those fall invaders. So every fall, they are finding ways to get up underneath the siding or up through vents. And then as they wake up, they filter in the house. And it's not just pines. They'll feed on spruce cones, anything in the conifer family.
Okay, and we have about 30 pine trees in our yard.
Okay. So
how do I get rid of them? And do they? I know they fly. We didn't see them fly for a long time, but we did find out they can fly.
Mm-hmm.
But do they bite?
No.
Okay, I'm scared to death of them.
You know, and I can see why. You know, and this is one of those insects you got to be a little careful, because if you look at just its body shape and whatnot, there are blood feeding insects like cone nose bugs and other things that look very similar, but they don't live here. They live down in Mexico. So it is a seed feeder. But the problem was what was happening in September and October. You know, if you were going to put up a line of defense, you stop them before they get in by either spraying the outside of the house or, again, checking to make sure your vents are screened with a small enough screening that critters can't come in. You know, right now, you know, spraying is worthless. It isn't going to solve anything, and so you just kind of have to deal with what you're seeing. Sometimes you get lucky, and, you know, if they always show up in the sunroom, you kind of say, well, how are they getting in? And you start looking at, you know, light fixtures and other things, thinking that they're in the walls or in the attic and they're pushing through. And sometimes you can, you know, tape something, seal something, keep them in the wall so in the spring of the year they move back out. But as I said, next year I think I'd be quite a bit more aggressive in the fall.
I have a lot of them. They're just enough to annoy me. You know, like find five during the winter. You know, it's not a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like them. They're ugly. I don't want to share my house with them.
Sure.
I want them to go to their own home.
Right. Well, unfortunately, you know, they made a wise choice from their part, because they've got a very good shelter place that makes it easier. And again, this is one of those insects. It is officially, we think, from the West Coast. And about 20 years ago, they decided to move in the Midwest and also in the East. And so it's a relatively new headache for us. But why all of a sudden is an interesting question, because, you know, people have moved back and forth for the last 100 years. But it has been a recent outbreak, and they're never as numerous as box elder bugs, but they're even maybe more dependable, might be a way of me putting it, because I expected once they started becoming a problem, I would have samples coming in every year.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks so much for your help.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Ellen in Eau Claire has a question for us. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
My husband and I are just plagued with our pantry moth, and we don't know what is going on, because we have done everything. We have taken everything out and frozen everything, mm-hmm. and then thrown out anything that might even have them in it, and cleaned this thing once a month. We got rid of them in the summer, but now they're back, and I found these little moths in my lentils and what's the other things, chia seeds, and not in the flour, but not in and maybe one or two of the cereals, and then a few nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And then they are all over the place. They are, we open the cupboard and one flies out, and it's we hit it and it just disintegrates, you know. But we can't seem to get them, and we don't know what to do. We did buy spray, and so we're desperate.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm not a fan of spray, because the way I explain it to people is if they're in something food-related and you throw it out and that's the only place they are, you've solved the problem, whereas you can't spray the food. But I'll relate my own personal pain with this, because it kind of shows how intricate it can sometimes be. Ours started in the Pelletieri household in birdseed in the garage, and that's not that unusual. We kept feeding the bird seed. Well, eventually they found their way into our cupboards, and we threw out rice and noodles and the kind of dry goods, anything that is defined as dried plant material. So it could be seeds, spices, the like. But what had happened, so after we go through the clean out, the suggestion is you store things in substantial, you know, Tupperware or other things, you know, just a baggie that's tied with a twistum is not enough. But, you know, the things that you have around for a period of time, 3 or 4 months, it's got to be in a container that they can't get through. Glass jars is fine. But we kept getting this trickle, and it was not in the kitchen anymore. And so that was the first clue. And so I spent months trying to hunt down the source. And, of course, my wife would tease me or sometimes not tease me when we found a moth of, you know, where's the source coming? So the same kind of frustrations you have. And what it finally traced to, and it took a number of months for me to solve this, is it was a True Value hardware store bag on one of my basement shelves that I would have swore to you had screws or nuts or something in it. But what it had was some vegetable seeds that my father-in-law had given me years before, and I had just forgot about them. So, okay. You know, you if the problem persists in the kitchen, then the source is the kitchen. If they start showing somewhere else, you have to look at Christmas wreaths made out of walnuts. I mean, other dry good type things that are not food related, but could be. I mean, even the kids, you know, always in kindergarten used to make flour paste pitchers, and of course you store them away. They could breed on that type of thing. So you kind of have to hunt it down. So the combination of putting things, so if you miss something, they're either contained and can't get out, or if it's something new, they can't reinfest. Now, the one other caveat I'll throw at you that I've seen problems in the past is people who have had a problem with mice, where the mice have taken food and stashed it in the walls, or old-fashioned mouse bait that is grain-based but has you know, mouse poisons. Either of those can be a food source for these kind of pantry moths. So,
well, what was the second thing you said besides
mouse baits? You know, decon mouse packs or whatnot that you can throw in the attic and other places. The poisons that are used to kill rats don't kill insects. And so
we have that in the garage, which is very close to my utility room. And we also have bird seed, a lot of bird seed outside.
Okay. Well, so the thing about the garage should be cold enough now that it puts a stop to the activity, unless the garage is heated.
No.
But, you know, when you go through the clean out, you expect a dramatic improvement. You might get a trickling for 2 or 3 weeks, but if it persists past that, they've done an end run on you. They have found something else, and they're starting the game over again, and that's what gets so frustrating. So as I said, keep in mind, it doesn't have to be food products. It could be dried plant material, potpourri. I mean, all kinds of things will potentially be it. But the other thing is that, you know, spraying, as I said, doesn't get you very far because you're not spraying where the fire really is. And if you can find what's infested and throw it out, you go from there.
There you go.
Oh, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Ellen. Thank you so much for calling. And let's go to Lake Villa, Illinois next and hear from Brian. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Mary. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I had another solution for dealing with ants. I had some problems mostly outside, but I've dealt with boric acid a lot. But I found that if I grind some sugar very fine in a mortar and pestle and mix it with an equal amount of boric acid and then place it near the entry point for the ants, that way they pick up the sugar and the boric acid and take it back to the nest.
Yeah, it can be a little more complicated than that from a couple standpoints. One, ants are liquid feeders. And so, honestly, a liquid base mix of sugar and water should be more effective than the dry-based product.
Oh.
Secondly, you got to be a little careful not to put too much boric acid because at a certain point it becomes a repellent. So there are boric acid baits. The taro ant poison that's on the market now is basically a sugar base with boric acid at a 1% solution, something like that. And there are commercial things. And again, I'm sure people can get some home remedies on the internet to mix up. The other thing is that the ants that don't like sweets could care less. And so if you see them ignoring sweets, then you have to go to something that is more fat-based. So, you know, cooking oils and the like mixed with boric acid would work. So it's an interesting thing. I mean, boric acid is very effective. It's a slow-acting stomach poison, which is what you want in an ant poison. So they take it back and feed it to other members of the colony and hopefully the queen. And so, if you've got a home remedy that works, that's fine. But as I said, the two cautions is you can't go too heavy with the boric acid. And generally, the best ant baits are liquids because way the ants feed.
All right.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. And Kay and Madison, your turn. Hi, what can we do for you?
Hi, well, I'll tell you what worked for me with pantry moths. I went through and I threw out everything that I had questions about, but I still would get some, not as many, pantry moths. And I couldn't figure out what to do. And I went to a hardware store, and they had some lures when you fold them up, look like a little tent.
Mm-hmm.
And inside the tent, the sides of the tent were sticky there was a little bait inside that they said was kind of a lure for pantry moths. And I caught 15 in one lure and 15 in the other. And I still have them up, but I could probably throw them away. I haven't had pantry moths for months now.
Okay. It is a technique, but what I warn you is most lures are out there are using pheromones that only attract male moths.
Huh.
So they're dynamite for monitoring and telling you what's going on. I have seen a couple companies be playing with lures that both attract males and females, but technically what they're exploiting is the female gives off a chemical that attracts the male. That's what's in the lure. And so, but one of the arguments is in the right scenarios, if you are trapping the males faster than they can find a mate, you can solve the problem right there. But, you know, if people have a very heavy infestation, that's the warning I've got with these lure traps, is that you're only capturing males and you'll never gain on them enough without going through the other steps of the sanitation and the like. And as I said, on the other side of it, this is the technique that pest control companies will use in warehouses, because the lures are sensitive enough that you'll start picking up moths way before you see them visually. So it's a great way of saying, yeah, they're here because I'm catching them in these lure traps.
Ah, interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Kay. Thanks for calling. I was thinking back a lot. Years ago, we had them and couldn't figure it out and finally discovered that they were coming out of the dog food, my roommate's dog food. Got rid of that, and we got rid of the...
Yeah, it can really be frustrating at times. As I said, sometimes the biggest thing, you expect them in the kitchen. When you consistently see them in rooms other than the kitchen, that suggests that that's where the problem is. And as I said, so if it's the bathroom, I pick on the potpourri. If it's in the basement, you think something you got stored away in a box somewhere. And of course, we all have things in the basement that that we forgot about. And so it can take quite a bit of time, but the detective work is well worth it because that's how you solve it.
Ron in White Lake, on to you now. Hi, Ron.
Hello, and happy holidays to all.
To you as well.
Up here in northern Wisconsin, I have a question about termites. I really have never seen a termite up here, but things are changing. We're seeing new bugs come into the state. Wondering about, in home construction, if we should start to take some measures to prevent, or not to prevent termites, but at least you could see termites if they're infecting the framing of the house. And there's some things you can do down at the sill plate.
Sure.
So I'm wondering if you think we might see termites coming into the northern part of the state in years to come.
So if I had to draw a line, my termite line goes from Green Bay through Toma and then up to about south of Eau Claire. I have seen termites south of there, but the interesting thing is that the cases that we see, the termites have been brought in on landscape timbers or other situations. And then once they're here, because of the heat of a house, they can survive. Finding termites in the woods, it isn't here yet. In fact, we still are about at the Wisconsin-Illinois border for it to be at all possible to see what I consider wild termites. But I ran out of fingers and toes on the number of communities that have infestations that most of the time we can trace back to people bringing in, and then they go from there. So a couple things. You know, we do a lot of things in our building codes that people don't pay attention to that should cost us a lot in termites, and we don't see it. So, down south, you can't build a house without pre-treating the soil before you even put the foundation and whatnot, because termites are so commonplace. We have no laws like that in the state, and we don't need them yet. 200 years from now, I might change the story, but right now, I think you're safe. And as I said, my only caution would be, is if you're bringing in railroad ties or landscape timbers, to be very careful, because that has been a problem so many times. As I said, in fact, there has not been a case that I was involved with professionally that when we could find a source that it turned out not to be that, you know, that it was something. And, you know, sometimes it was, in one case in a community, it was a gentleman. We don't know why he did this. He collected railroad timbers in the back of his house, not that he used them. They were just stacked up. And 25 years later, you found that there's a four-block area that's infested, and you could probably trace it all back to that.
Oh, boy. Well, thank you.
Thanks, Ron. And, boy, Lucas in Green Bay, thank you for calling.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hey, you have a good point about those termites. I'm a pest control technician up here in Green Bay, And I do have to say that the only time I see termites is when I'm down in Oshkosh or Fond du Lac or that area.
Yeah, although to be honest, we did see a couple cases in Green Bay in my career that people had picked up. But yeah, you know, Oshkosh and Fond du Lac has a rather long-standing, even before I started at the university, there were known termite infestations up there. There's been problems up in Sheboygan. I mean, it's real spotty, and they kind of slowly get bigger, but not, again, we don't have communities that require during a real estate transaction to have inspections. To be honest, there's three or four communities in the state I think there should be, because termites are that commonplace. But
absolutely.
Yes.
And I have another question real quick, if I could.
Sure.
About fruit flies. Mm-hmm. Now, is that simply a sanitation issue, or is that something that can be handled in other ways?
Boy, it's kind of like that pantry moth problem that people get. If you don't find the source, it's going to drive you crazy. And you know, the thing about fruit flies is there has to be a source of organic matter, there has to be some moisture, and really what the maggots feed on is the yeast associated with things that are fermenting. And so that's why it's so commonly, you know, people point at bananas, but the bananas that are on your kitchen, even though that attracts the adults, they're not ripe enough yet to breed the fruit flies. So you look
for... I
always
like to check behind the refrigerator on those cooling things where all the dust and stuff collects. Is that a good place to check for them?
Well, you know, that, and if it's got an evaporation plan, if they get kind of slimy, you can get breeding in that slime and goop. You know, a sour mop, you know, something that the kids spilled some orange juice, and you clean it up, you don't rinse the mop out. There's enough organic matter in that juice, and then it stays wet. They can breed on that. And the case I tell, again, back when my kids were small, we had them breeding in two paper cups that had Kool-Aid in it. So the organic matter source was the sugar. You know, as it started to evaporate, it got kind of goopy and jello-y and stuff, and the yeast is starting to break down on that. And so you always have this kind of fruity, fermenting, vinegary smell if you get to the source in most cases. But, boy, it can drive you crazy because, again, it's so often out of the way. And, of course, I'm sure you've experienced when you're servicing commercial accounts, you know, the goop is up underneath tiles and other places. It's not very visible.
Yeah.
And, honestly, the more they wash, the more water we add to the system, and they're pushing the organic matter underneath the tile and whatnot. And so it just keeps on going. And so it does take, again, a lot of hands and knees sometimes of figuring out where the source is. And then, of course, if you adjust it and you stop the moisture, to stop the organic matter, the fruit flies go away.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Dan in Milwaukee, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing. What's on your mind?
Well, we have a place on the country. It's kind of a ranch, and it's got a lot of outbuildings and things like that. And we kind of got tired of dealing with rodents and insects, and we hired a pest control service with a contract on a regular basis. So they keep the house basically free from that sort of thing. What we're getting is outside on every south-facing building, if it's in the late summer, if the building's dark, it gets covered with fox elder bugs.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's light, like we have a travel trailer that's got the whitish siding on it, it gets covered with Asian beetles. And I mean covered, you know? You try and open the door to get in, and they're just swarming everywhere. And I just don't know how to deal with it.
So, you know, again, what these things are reacting to is, you know, it starts in early September for box elder bugs. It goes a little bit later for Asian lady beetles. But their behavior is to spend the winter somewhere, and they seem to be attracted to sunny areas. So south side is the classic place you expect them to congregate. And, you know, cloudy days, cool days, you know, your activity can kind of ebb and flow a little bit, but this window of activity is really the time. If you're going to stop it, you stop it. And what they're using basically is the equivalent of some of the barn sprays that we use for fly control. There's a number of insecticides that can spray on the surface, and they'll give you about 3 weeks of knockdown. So anything that lands on that will be killed before it can get in or bother you or whatnot. But as I said, you've got to do it in that window time. And so you mark the calendar the first week of September to get out there on the south side. Sometimes east side's usually not the north side, because if there's not sunlight hitting the surface, or the other interesting thing is if you planted big shady trees all around the buildings, you would rarely get much activity because you don't get that sun and heat sink that kind of seems to draw them in.
Box elder, right?
Right. This is box elder and the Asian lady beetle. And so, as I said, you can go to Farm and Fleet or the like, or you can talk to your pest control service. You know, they can spray it, but it's a seasonal thing. You know, if they say they want to spray it every month for the problem, that's not solving it. As I said, it's this little window, and they've got the kind of sprays, the knockdowns, and these newer insecticides work much better when it's cold. You know, back when I first started, the insecticides of choice honestly weren't very good when it was cold, and so it really became frustrating. And this is exactly when you're getting that temperature change going on, and so you need something that's going to be effective when it's 40 degrees or the like, aside from when it's 65.
There we go. Thanks, Dan. Thanks for calling. Terrence in Madison. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I just had a question regarding some tiny little flies that I've been getting. Right this season, I'm not having too much trouble, but in the warmer months, I get them in my house, and particularly in my living room. And when I notice them, you can't even see them during the day when there's plenty of light out. But I'll lay down on the couch, turn off the lights in the room, and all I've got is the light from the computer screen. I got, you know, about 40 of them swarming around the computer screen, and they're really tiny.
I mean, do you have houseplants?
Like millimeter or two.
Yeah, do you have any houseplants in the house?
I have a few, yeah.
Okay. My first guess is they're fungus gnats coming out of the houseplant soil.
Okay.
You know, and they can be quite frustrating. They don't hurt the houseplants, but... And the way to deal with this, there are some bacterial insecticides that are considered organic that you can mix with a houseplant soil, and it will kill the maggots. It doesn't kill the adults, but basically if you stop the breeding, that will solve it. Okay. You will see some people suggest, you know, less watering. Well, that's a relative thing, you know, that if you put too little water, your plants aren't going to survive. So as I said, I really suspect it's coming out of your houseplants, and that's why you'll see it ebb and flow. It may slow down a bit in the winter just because of the lower humidities, but anytime we get little gnats, that's the first place I go to.
Okay.
Thanks. All right. Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, our guest today. He's retired as head of the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, retired in 2014. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Larry Mueller, and we have an open line or two, so join in at 1-800-642-1234. If you got an insect ID question and you have a photo, you can post it up on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page, or just an interesting insect. Heck, we want to take a look at it, too, so post it up on our Facebook page. Let's go to John in Milwaukee next. Hi, John.
Hello. Say, this summer, I was in Chicago, and I'm a bus driver. I was sitting on the edge of a luggage compartment, and something fell in the luggage bay next to me. And here it turns out it was this wasp that had clutched a cicada. Mm-hmm. And, like, its mandible was bit into the back of the cicada's head, and it was holding onto several of its other legs. But this wasp was giant. Yes. I'll try and describe it. It was
I know what it is. They call it a cicada killer. And that's all they do is they capture cicadas, they dig a hole in the ground, they drag the cicada in there, they lay their egg, and then they're gone. So this is not a nest, per se. They're the biggest, meanest wasp you will see. And one of the things that I find intriguing, being a Wisconsin person, when I grew up, they weren't here. I mean, you'd have to go down to Indianapolis to go find them. But they're on the Madison campus, have been for a number of years. In fact, we even did a piece with the Wisconsin Gardener years ago with Shelley Ryan on cicada killers because they're such a unique-looking creature. And, again, they're very scary. The males don't sting. The females, you would have to really mess with them to get stung. So they're not aggressive, per se, as far as stinging people, but they're very curious. And so if you step out on the sidewalk, they'll come and fly right at you, you know, wondering what the devil you're doing here type of thing. And, yeah, it is something. And usually you see them in flower beds and other places where there's soil that they can dig into. In fact, one of the strategies, if you're trying to move them out of an area, is put a whole lot of mulch in there, you know, so they can't dig through to get to the dirt. And then they'll go find some other place to make their burrows.
And what do they look like?
They look like a giant yellow jacket. By giant, I mean they're 2 inches long. So think about it. If they're big enough to physically overwhelm a cicada, which is a couple inches long, they're a hefty creature. And and as I said, they are, relatively speaking, this is one of those, you know, Phil is going to get his book written. In fact, the rule is that if there's snow on the ground, I have to write. And so this looks like the winter to finish it. But as I said, to me, the interesting part of the story is it was not found here. And we think that the warmer winters have allowed these things to kind of move up, because it was more, to me, a southern creature, but not anymore.
Yeah, no, it was kind of a scary insect, thinking, boy, if I got stung by that thing, I'd be gone.
Yeah, no.
Anyway, okay.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. All right, let's go to Ron in Wallace, Michigan next. Hi, Ron.
Good morning to you.
Morning to you.
Yes, I would like to know the difference between a sand dauber wasp and a paper wasp. Are they similar in appearance?
Because yes.
They're raising havoc in my garage.
Yeah, but typically the sand daubers, and there's a number of ones, just like this previous critter, the cicada killer, that will dig burrows in the ground, and some catch spiders and some catch crickets and different creatures. Whereas the paper wasps, as the name implies, construct a nest, and whether it's the Polistes type that make the open-faced nest where you can see the combs inside it, or the ones that envelope the nest, like the yellow jackets and the like, they're all predators. They all collect spiders or other insect-type creatures for their food. But the difference is the paper wasp has a queen and has a nest to defend, whereas the ground creatures that are making burrows don't have a true nest, and for that reason, they're far less aggressive. So that, to me, is the biggest difference, is that paper wasp, the nest gets bigger as the year goes on, and if they feel threatened, you've got a problem with sometimes hundreds of wasps, whereas the digging type of wasps, because they might have a bunch in an area, but they're each individual burrows, and they tend to be much more passive and much more tolerant of people and much less likely to get stung.
Well, the sand dauber wasps are in the ground?
Yes. The true ones. So,
okay, are they similar in appearance to the paper wasp?
Yeah,
they're flying around my garage, and I was able to buy a spray at Menards called Zeb. It's for grease and all that, and that really takes care of them. Mm-hmm. You know, I spray that on them, and they're dead. But
so
what
are
they doing? Is they're going in every little crevice and every little hole in my garage, in my radio, in my power tools, and they're depositing. What are they depositing that turns into a hard concrete?
So, what you're seeing are one of these wasps, not a true paper wasp, but one of these wasps that will, in some states, like the Oregon dauber or whatnot, they will construct small cells of mud and other things. And what they're often looking for is a particular diameter size hole to make this mud. But then again, they go out and collect whatever their prey is, bring it, stuff it in this tube that they've constructed, lay their egg, and then they're done with it. So in this case, there just must be a lot of neat places for them to get to.
Well, that's just exactly what's happening. All my power tools have screw holes with that particular diameter, and they just fill that hole with their mud. They get into the switches on my power tools, and they just freeze up the switch, and they even got into a radio in my garage and got into the circuit board, and I was wondering why my radio didn't work.
Yeah, and that's really a problem, because you really can't spray into those tools because the sprays are not made for that and can cause shorting problems and the like.
Well, what I could do is, like my leaf blower, I put it inside a paper bag.
Yeah.
Anything, or a cabinet.
Yeah, anything, I was thinking the same thing with some of the tools, although it might be a bother, is getting big plastic tubs and storing things in them so they can't get access. Because, as I said, I don't know of an easy answer other than, maybe setting up a fan so that there's so much wind blowing they can't come in through the door. But, other than that, there is no easy answer to this. But What they're looking for is exactly what you're seeing, a particular diameter. And it's unusual to get as much activity as you've got, but if they're in the neighborhood, I guess I can see that they're taking advantage of it.
Yeah, well, it's my garage where I have the problem. It's an attached garage, and, of course, you know, the garage has got all kinds of openings in it. You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they get in there and they freeze that. fix the tool, and there's mud in the hole, a screw hole.
Yeah, no, we've had this problem. We've had this problem, honestly, with outside electrical outlets sometimes that some of these wasps, and there's some bees that do similar things, will plug the stuff up, and it really, again, is not an easy fix because it's not as if you can spray something to make them go away because they're moving through the air all the time. I mean,
yeah.
They're not coming to one spot.
I like the tub idea, though.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's a little bit of a pain in the butt, but...
Or as I said, he solved the one with putting a bag over the leaf blower so they couldn't find it.
Yeah. So there you go.
Once it gets hard, you got to chip it out, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a pain. It's definitely a pain. Thanks, Ron, for calling. Appreciate it. Chad in Coon Rapids, Minnesota, you are next. Hi, Chad.
Well, I'm actually tuned in today because I'm driving through Wisconsin, but appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
Kind of a funny question. When I was a kid growing up, I remember ladybugs being both orange and pink.
Mm-hmm.
I have not seen a pink ladybug in over a decade. Why is that?
Well, you know, in most states, we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 60 different kinds of ladybugs. And so there is one, Coleomagella, I know it as, or a friend of mine used to describe ladybugs by their pattern. So he called that the 23232. But one of the interesting things, when this multicolored Asian lady beetle moved into areas of the United States, many populations of our native species took a big dive.
Yeah.
And so they have not become extinct, but they're far less common because there's only so much ladybug food to go around, and this Asian species has kind of taken over. The one thing I'll tell you, though, is that in the last 15 years or so, watching in Wisconsin, the number of Asian lady beetles has been going down quite a bit, and I have seen a bit of a resurgence. So there are still pink ladybugs out there if you really look hard, but I think what you've seen, as I said, is this, we call it competitive displacement, but this exotic Asian species is pushing out many of our native species like this Coleomagella.
And 10 years is about right, too, isn't it?
Yes, yes, from what we're watching. And you know, towards the end of my years in the lab, the number of complaints went down dramatically. But it was a relative thing. You know, people that used to get 5,000 Asian lady beetles in the house were down to 70. That's still enough to make them unhappy. But if you look at how bad they were when they first came versus now, as I said, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that things are balancing out a little bit better.
There we go.
Very, very interesting.
All right. Thanks, Chad.
Hey, I had one other thing.
Okay.
You guys were talking about the ground-dwelling wasps, and I was convinced that the one I had under my front step was a cicada killer, and I've left them alone. I mean, I got four kids, but like you said, they're not a harm to anybody. They're big and scary looking, but that's about it. Now, 5 years later, I think we probably got about 40 that come out in the summer, and they're only out for about 2-3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I read that was going to be the case with them, so that's kind of why I left them alone. But they come in with bugs that aren't cicadas, however. Now, the wasp is black, and it's got like an iridescent blue wing.
Sure.
And I'm just curious what kind that is.
Okay, so the cicada killer is yellow-striped in kind of black, but the very distinctive striping. What you have is either the cricket hunters is what I'm thinking of, which are a type of thread-waisted wasp that collect grasshoppers and katydids and other similar things. Same type of thing. They make burrows, they put their prey in, they lay their eggs, and then they're gone. But if you've got a good habitat, I can tell, you know, the ones that come out this summer are going to find and come back and be active. So I'm not surprised that they're continually there. But as I said, it's a very similar story. It's just that their prey is different. And if you look carefully, you're going to see either crickets, grasshoppers, or green grasshoppers, what we call katydids, would be the prey for that kind of wasp.
That seems about right for the size that I see them come flying in with.
Mm-hmm.
And when they come in with something, they're coming in hot. You better watch out. They can't really maneuver too well.
Right. Well, you know, you can imagine, you know, basically carrying something that's heavy, if not even heavier than you are, and trying to fly with it. That's an amazing feat.
Right.
Hey, appreciate your time. Have a great day, guys.
Yeah, you as well. Thanks, Chad. Gary and Racine, hi to you.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You were talking about insects that burrow into the ground, and I don't think I have wasps, but this fall I noticed all over the west side of the yard these little burrows, like, you know, little piles of dirt and mud. And my neighbor claims that he has problems on his roses with Japanese beetles. I'm wondering if it's something to do with that or something else.
My first thought before you brought Japanese beetle is that they're worm castings. Because okay. Night crawlers, especially if you've got maples and the like, will make very distinctive holes. Usually you'll see some kind of crusting and debris around the top, so they, you know, almost looks like little volcanoes.
Okay.
Japanese beetles, you know, sometimes when they emerge, you can see, you know, well, my colleague Chris Williamson was working in golf courses, can find, you know, numbers of 50, 60 per square foot. And when the beetles come through, you got to believe there's lots of holes. But that would typically happen in July and early August. And I just have never seen them so much that the holes catch my attention. So as okay. I said, I just wondered. Now, what we always suggest to folks in this case is go out at night with a flashlight. And if it's night crawlers, it'll be pretty obvious.
Okay.
And the like. But that... And usually you'll find it, like, under maples. They're shady enough. The turf is, or you know, grass is kind of thin. And I think that makes those holes even more apparent.
Okay. All right. Yeah, the grass is thinning a little bit in that area. And my other thought was to take a shovel or something and dig down into one of the holes around the hole to maybe see what's in there.
Yeah. You know? No, and you know, if it was insect-related, you would find, again, a pile of grasshoppers or leafhoppers or other food sources type of thing. The thing with Japanese beetle, I mean, their grubs are in the ground for a year. You know, you see the grubs quite commonly in the late summer, and that would be apparent.
Yeah. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri will be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back with Phil. Stay with us. Taking a look at the world of insects here in Wisconsin today with Phil Pelletieri, our entomologist, Distinguished Faculty Associate Emeritus at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for joining us. One open line at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us, the email address talk@WPR.org, or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And let's turn right back to the phones and Daryl in Iron Mountain, Michigan. Hi, Daryl. Thank you for calling.
Yes, good evening. I have a problem in the springtime with roses. We have a lot of beautiful roses in your yard, and they just start getting to bloom very nicely, and we get these lime green bugs on them by the hundreds, and they just totally destroy them. How do I get rid of them?
Oh, yeah, they love roses.
Okay, so roses have well over 100 insects that eat them. I mean, they're one of the roses and apples are the two most susceptible plants I know to critters. So I'm interested, these worm-like creatures, or are they little beetle-like creatures?
Little beetle-like creatures.
Oh, I'm afraid you were going to say that.
Yeah.
So a critter is called the imported weevil, imported green weevil, I've seen it referred to. It is an European species. It feeds on a bunch of things, birch trees, you name it. But the frustration is it's not something I can say, well, you do this in your yard and you stop the breeding, they'll go away, because they're basically coming in from all the woods around you. And that's where the problem lies, is that, you know, chemicals last for 3 days and these things are active for 2 or 3 weeks. And so I don't know if there's an easy answer. You know, as I said, there are sprays. If you're looking for something organic, there's a product called Spinosad. Dr. Jack's Dead Bug Brew is one of the names. It would kill them for 3 or 4 days. But, you know, you're always, if plants are in bloom, then you've got bee issues. You don't want to spray plants that are in bloom because you kill the bees.
Exactly.
And so, as I said, there really is not an easy way for me to stop it, because I can't put out the source of the fire. And I was hoping it was the little green worms we call rose slugs. And I'd say, well, you can spray some soapy water about the 15th or 20th of May to kill the little tiny larvae. They just cause a browning of the leaves. They leave the flowers alone. But as I said, this little imported weevil, it is iridescent under a microscope. It really is stunning in as far as its coloration. But the unfortunate thing is it's a general feeder on a lot of different plants. And as I said, they just keep flying in and keep flying in and keep flying in.
Yeah. You're right about the color. They are stunning, but I'd rather see the rose than the stunning green.
Yeah. Are they not emerald ash?
No. They're probably about 3 millimeters long. You know, they have this distinctive snout if you look at them. Their grubs are in the ground feeding on the roots of various plants. That does not seem to be very much of an issue. We see them a lot where we got a lot of poplar, birch in particular. So it's more of a northern Wisconsin, upper Michigan type of problem. We do not see them of any problem in the southern part of the state, but it's the difference between the kind of trees that we have here.
Okay.
All right, there we go. Sorry, Daryl.
All right.
All right, take care. Ted and Marinette, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Hey,
just a question, a couple questions. You mentioned emerald ash borers. Just curious where they're at in the state right now and when we can expect them up in northern Wisconsin.
Well, you know, there is a known infestation up in the Superior Duluth area, and there are an infestation up in the UP also. You know, I don't keep the records as close as I did, but basically, I think about two-thirds of the state now is under quarantine. And, you know, just watching the way this goes, we're adding somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 to 12 counties a year as far as activity.
Marinette, I'd expect them almost to be there already.
Yeah, Green Bay's had positive confirmations now for about 5 years. I said, without looking at the map, but if you go either to the DNR site or Department of Ag, they'll show you what counties are under quarantine, and they'll probably show you the ones that went positive this year. And as I said, I know it was a list of at least 9 or 10 more counties that we've had problems with. And other than, as I said, the infestation up in the Superior area, which is about 3 years old, and there is a longer-standing one in parts of the UP I'm aware of.
Yeah.
Are they pretty... when you get a emerald ash borer in a specific county or a specific area, do they pretty much knock out all the trees, or are they specific and random?
Yeah,
or?
The way to relate it from what we experience in watching in Michigan and the like is it's like Dutch elm disease. I mean, it starts as a trickle, but it gets going, and unless the trees are protected, they're ash trees, they will be killed. Now, it might in an individual county take 20 years, but it's inevitable. It does not seem to be, all of our native species of ash seem to be very, very susceptible. People are looking at some of the Asian species that seem to have some resistance. So maybe somewhere down the road there will be ornamental trees that are resistant to it, because this does not cause this kind of problem in its country of origin. But it's kind of typical of an insect out of place. And as I said, our native ash trees don't have a natural defense, and that's why they're so susceptible.
Oh, yeah. Now, on another note, the main reason I called was about, with winter on the way in here, I've got a cabin up north of Eagle River, and I always seem to get cluster flies. Some years worse than others, and I don't know if that's the right name for them.
Yes, it is. It is. That is the most common fall invading or winter fly or the like, yes.
Yeah. Is there anything you can do to prevent them or to slow them down or to...
Well, so the ebb and flow is they are earthworm parasites by nature. So years that you got a lot of earthworms, there should be lots of cluster flies. In dry years, they're far less common. Where your cabin is sitting, the more exposed, the more cluster flies that are drawn to it. But this is one of the ones where an outside spraying the walls and overhangs and the like at the right time of the year is the way to do it. They're using synthetic pyrethroid insecticides, which are the dominant sprays you get now. So, you know, there are sprays you can get at the co-op and Farm and Fleet or even the hardware store. But the timing for cluster flies, I would say up your way, is about the 1st of September. And in particular, the exposed sunny areas. So south side for sure, probably east side. The other thought is, you know, you always tell people you can seal them out, but in a cabin, that is not the easiest thing to do, because you can think it can be very tight, but they can still find ways to work up through the crevices and the like. And so the typical thing is you go up there, you know, you're in deer camp, you start the fire and whatnot, and all of a sudden there's this explosion of flies. That's classic cluster flies. They were in the walls hibernating, but the warmth has woke them up. But you can't let them get in the walls, so that's why the strategy is spraying the outside first week of September.
Gotcha. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Mac in Plover has something for us. Hi, Mac.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I have a question about an insecticide called bifenthrin, and I think it's, I don't know how easy it is to get, but would that be good to use on Asian lady beetles?
Yes, it's in that family of compounds that is very active. When you buy the formulation, you know, read the directions because, you know, some stuff is basically labeled for spraying on plants. The stuff that is labeled for spraying on houses that do this sometimes is formulated differently so it sticks better. So some of the stuff that's made for spraying on the houses should not be put on plants. And so, as I said, if you're trying to get the best bang for your buck, that's the way to go is to get bifenthrin. There are other products. There's a Cyhalothrin is another insecticide. Generally, if they end in THRIN, they're one of these pyrethroid insecticides.
Are they as good as I can get to use now?
Yes, although the formulations are, you know, so it's not just the chemicals, it's how they're formulated. The stuff that is microencapsulated is basically formulated to have a longer residual. And the way of thinking of it, these are kind of tiny little plastic balls that the insecticide is impregnated in. So when you spray it on a surface, it lasts quite a bit longer. That's what I said. I would think the microencapsulated formula of any of the pyrethroids is the way to go if you're going to treat these kind of things.
Okay.
All right.
You were talking about spiders earlier, and I have noticed that if I spray bifenthrin under my eaves or in my pontoon boat, there are no spiders.
Yeah.
You get rid of their food.
Yes, but also you get rid of the spiders. I mean, spiders are harder to kill, but there are pyrethroid sprays that will give some knockdown. And again, it's a similar story. Now, the one warning is these chemicals are not to be put in water. They're very toxic to fish. So you got to be very selective on, you don't want stuff dripping in the water and the like, because again, it is not good for the way fish breathe. And so even though it's not very toxic to us or birds or other things, it does have some wildlife that's sensitive, and that's why you'll see some cautions about being very careful around water.
And it's good for ants too, right?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling. Got a caller who couldn't stay on the line but wants to know why she would have mosquitoes breeding in her house this time of year. She's seeing lots of young mosquitoes around the house.
Okay. Breeding, probably not, but could there be adult mosquitoes in the house? Yes. There's one genus in particular called Culex that spends the winter naturally in caves and tree holes and the like, and we do see them come in and basically hang out on basement walls. So people could get mosquito bites in January. The reason you don't typically get breeding is that it's not just water. It's got to be water that have some organic matter, because the larvae are feeding on that. And usually we don't have that kind of water source in a house. Now, there are also other gnats that are mosquito-like but don't bite that look very similar. So if it persists, this might be a case that's worth getting a couple, three, and send them down to PJ at the diagnostic lab just to make sure what you got. But typically, if you got a microscope, you know, mosquitoes have that long feeding tube or beak, whereas the other kinds of gnats that we get don't. They'll have different mouth parts, much, much shorter.
Bill in Green Bay is our next caller. Hi, Bill.
Good afternoon to both of you. I wanted to talk about flea control. Mm-hmm. And during the past 3 months, I seem to be getting more and more fleas, although I'm using medications on the dog, and I've had the rugs cleaned, and I do pick up every day, sometimes twice a day, with a vacuum cleaner, and I have also used a debugger, so to speak, that you can turn on for a couple of hours with pyrethrins in them, and we're of course not. We can't be in the rooms then.
Mm-hmm.
Or what else can I do? The natural products didn't seem to work very well.
So, you just have dogs, or do you have other pets?
Just a dog.
Mm-hmm.
A very thick, furry dog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are you using for the dog?
Well, I use the recommendations from the vet. First, it was a pill, and I found that the topical ones were better than the pill, because he tolerated topical better than the pill.
Sure. So in a case like yours, there's something that's not adding up. And I'll just relate, again, my experiences is typically a dog flea infestation is easier to control than a cat flea infestation, even though it's the same flea. And part of that is the cats get the darn fleas breeding in places that are hard to get to and people don't think about. So, you know, it sounds like you're following directions and doing things right. So then my experience is sometimes when these things don't clean up, the next question is there a different source? And more than once, I have found raccoons in attics or raccoons in chimneys, which get the same flea, as being the source. And then the fleas kind of spill into the household and they bother everybody, and we keep treating the dog and we keep treating the household. So it sounds like there's a little bit more detective work that at least be worth doing, because they said the first thing your story is telling me is you're doing things right. It should be getting better, especially the products from the vet. You know, you get a little nervous. Some of the, there has been some resistance in fleas to some of the over-the-counter things that people buy, but typically the vets have got are on top of that. And so I think it's worth talking with your vet, that your experiences have been you have not been able to get it under control. But as I said, with my interactions and these kind of problems, I'm going to start looking a different direction, as where indeed be a place that you're not treating that the fleas could be coming from. And that's where this wild animal story seems to come into play so often.
Is it possible that there are two bugs? Because I find lots of little green bugs in the beginning.
Yeah, there's no life stage of fleas that I would describe as green.
Okay, because I do have a neighbor had that problem last year, and this year they get in my clothes, on my back.
Those creatures, to be honest, if you can get any of those, send them down to PG, just the Insect Diagnostic Lab. The address is 1630 Linden Drive, Madison, and the university zip is 53706. You know, this is one of the ones that I think it's worth trying to find out who those critters are, because then I think we can point you in a different direction. It does not sound like it's related to fleas.
Okay. Thank you both, and have a great Christmas.
Thanks. You as well. Thank you so much. And Jill in Clintonville, your turn. Hello. Hi, Jill.
Hello there. Larry, everything you have on is interesting. I enjoy your program.
Thank you.
The question I have about a bug is I've got the cutest little fly in my bathroom. It's got, when it's sitting on the wall, it looks like a little black heart.
Mm-hmm.
And they're tiny, and I get them more so towards spring, but generally we'll have a few hanging around even in the winter. Can you tell me what they are? And even though they're cute, I'd like to get rid of them.
Sure. I suspect it's something we call a moth fly or a drain fly. And the moth fly comes from the fact that they're wings appear fuzzy, but what makes a fly to an entomologist only has one pair of wings. Moths technically have two pairs of wings, but the story here is the drain fly name is more suggestive of where they breed. You need quite a bit of moisture and some organic matter, and so floor drains that don't get flushed very well, or in a bathroom, the overflow cut that you have in your bathroom sink. You know, it's a place made in case the water gets too high to make sure that it doesn't come out of the sink. But so it gets kind of goopy and stuff in there, and that slimy stuff inside is enough to support the maggots, and that's where you get the breeding.
Okay.
What I would say is get a real good hot pail of water. So heat it up, be careful when you're handling it, and flush it down there so you're cleaning it, basically. Interesting enough, bleach doesn't work.
Bleach
does is sterilize the outer surface, and if there's a bit of a thick slime layer, it doesn't even get to the critters. So, you know, people who put bleach down their floor drains, because this could come from a floor drain too. Typically, though, I don't see that much accumulation of organic matter in, let's say, a tub drain or plus you're flushing water through that all the time. I can't rule out it isn't the sink drain, though, too, because sometimes even though you get a lot of water, things kind of build up. So if at all you can open that up, you know, plunge it, clean it, whatever. But as I said, hot water is about the best thing. If you got really, you know, anything above 120 degrees is going to kill the maggots. And it also should help clean away that crud, and then they shouldn't be able to breed.
All right. I appreciate your help. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. And Terry in Roberts, Wisconsin. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We did, like you suggested, in the fall and sprayed for the box elder and the Asian beetles. My concern was we have toads on the north side of the house exterior, mm-hmm. and some tree frogs in the woods nearby. Do we have to worry about the spray affecting them at all?
Somewhat. The activity times are such. So one of my solutions here, you know, if you want to be a little more careful is, you know, box elder bugs you can kill with a soapy water spray, or you can buy insecticidal soap. And the nice thing about that is there's no residual, meaning you kill the bugs in front of you, but there's nothing left to hurt anything. So that, in a sensitive environment, I think that's a better way to go. The pyrethroids in general, you know, the more traditional chemicals, as I said, frogs just aren't tolerant of insecticides or pesticides in general. You know, so anytime you can kind of avoid it, if you've got those kind of things around, I think you'll be fine. If you killed the box elder bug with soap and a toad ate it, no problem. You know, so as I said, that may be the way to go. And the one thing I would suggest, though, is if you're going that way, is go to the store and buy the stuff that's called insecticidal soap. There are lots of home remedies on the internet, but to be honest, a lot of soaps then have brighteners, all kinds of other strange chemicals that you probably didn't do you any good in killing the bugs and can potentially have harmful. Plus, the dosages, there's all kinds of things that can go wrong there. So they said, when you buy insecticidal soap, you're getting the right stuff, it's the right concentration, and it is a good contact kill for soft-bodied insects. So it doesn't kill beetles, but box elder bugs, aphids, all kinds of things, it's good stuff.
So for the beetles, would you just suggest doing it more restrictively, or?
Yeah, if when you're applying the stuff, you want it to stick to the surface and not drip. So to be honest, there's some cases you think about a paintbrush might be a better way of putting it. It depends on your sprayer. You don't want a lot of high pressure. You don't want stuff blowing all around. You want it to just go on lightly with a very light coating and dry there. Once it dries, it does not pose a problem to the toads and the frogs because it just isn't picked up in the same way. You know, so that would be the way. And for all these invading things, high overhangs, you know, around window frames, I don't worry so much on ground level because that's not where they're coming in. And that's where the toads and frogs would be. So being a little selective of where you apply it also, I think, would both make it work better and lessen the chance of wildlife being exposed.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks very much for calling. Somebody was wondering about bringing firewood into the house. Does it help to strip the bark if you're trying to keep the insects out?
Yes. Not all, but most of the bark beetles live under the bark. And so once you open it up and dry it, you're making it a lot easier. It depends how seasoned the firewood is. You know, most of the problems come in when the wood still has some moisture. I've got beetles that will take 2 or 3 years to come out of the wood, but they can't get back in it. So older season firewood tends to have less problem, although one headache you can bring in on occasion is powder post beetle, which is gets into seasoned wood. So, yes, debarking definitely lessens a whole lot of problems. Plus, there's a lot of insects that just hide under bark because it's a place to hang out. You bring them in the house, they warm up, they think it's spring, and so we get this kind of, we call them nuisance insects because they don't hurt anything. But again, it is tough storing firewood inside because it is a great place for a lot of critters to live.
Well, Phil, here we are out of time again. Boy, it flies by. And let's see, you're going to be back on February 15th, so the day after Valentine's Day is what it sounds like to me.
Sounds good.
Sounds very good. Thank you so much for being with us today. Phil Pelletieri is an entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus. He retired as the head of the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014, but PJ Leash is there. And so if you want to send an insect off to the Insect Diagnostic Lab, you can find the address and everything right online. And I think we have a link to it on our Facebook page as well. Well, let's see. Tomorrow at this time, Mary Mellum comes back with us to talk about some last-minute tax tips as we end the year. So I hope you can join us for that. And in the meantime, please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.